in the package of Pekudei, which is starting in Exodus chapter 38, is the parasha for the week. However, we will be looking mostly at 1 Kings chapter 7, verses, what is it, 51 through 821, something like that. And so I'll go ahead and read the 1 Kings passage, and we will reference back to Exodus as it comes up. Starting here. Thus all the work that King Solomon did in the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things that David his father dedicated, the silver, the gold, the vessels, and stored them in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel, before King Solomon in Jerusalem, to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. And all the men of Israel assembled to King Solomon at the feast in the month Etanim, which is the seventh month. And all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the Ark, and they brought up the Ark of the Lord, the tent of meetings, and all the holy vessels that were in the tent. The priests and the Levites brought them up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who had assembled before him were with him before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. Then the priest brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house, in the most holy place, underneath the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the ark, so that the cherubim overshadowed the ark and its poles. And the poles were so long that the ends of the poles were seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen from outside. And they are there to this day. There is nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made the covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And when the priest came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Then Solomon said, "The Lord has said that he would dwell in thick darkness. I have indeed built you an exalted house, a place for you to dwell in forever." Then the king turned and blessed all the assembly of Israel, while all the assembly of Israel stood. And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who with his hand has fulfilled what he promised with his mouth to David my father, saying, 'Since the day that I brought my people Israel out of Egypt, I chose no city out of all the tribes of Israel in which to build a house that my name might be there. But I chose David to be over my people Israel. Now it was in the heart of David my father to build a house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to David my father, whereas it was in your heart to build a house for my name, you did well that it was in your heart. Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son, who shall be born to you, shall build the house for my name. Now the Lord has fulfilled his promise that he made. For I have risen in the place of David my father and sit on the throne of Israel as the Lord promised, and I have built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. And there I have provided a place for the ark in which is the covenant of the Lord that he made with our fathers when he brought them out of the land of Egypt." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Again, you can tell that the passage is largely going to revolve around Exodus 38 through 40. In fact, Exodus 25 through 40 kind of repeats Almost three different times, the building of the temple or the building of the tabernacle in Exodus's case. First, you have the commandments to build it, which are found early on. God tells them how to build, what to build, what furniture to build, what types of metals, what types of wood, what type of cloth, what colors even. Colorful and rich and beautiful. Following that, you have another telling of the building of the tabernacle in which the people go ahead and use their skills, their abilities, and their free will to offer offerings to build the tabernacle. And then the final setting, which is what we would look at if we were in the Parashat HaShavua, you have the actual bringing of the temple before, or the tabernacle, excuse my thought pattern, two different things, the tabernacle in Exodus and the temple here in 1 Kings. You have the people bringing the articles, and indeed it says in Exodus 38 that they brought the actual tabernacle to Moses. Which is a very interesting phrase because you'd think, oh, they built it. And where they built it, Moses walks to it and he's like, yep, that's it. That's the one that God told me about. But they actually bring it to him with the utensils, with everything that is in it. And they place the articles within the tabernacle that they set up. They put the tent up in front of him, they bring it to him. And the tent is a temporary dwelling. It's something that moves with the people. And it had to move with the people because the people themselves were moving. They had not yet reached the land that God had promised Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, nor had they reached the location that God had chosen to put his name. Neither place had they reached. And so the tabernacle had to be able to be moved. And they bring it to Moses. Now, we finally come and we jump forward in time, quite a number of years, hundreds of years. And the people are in the land that God had promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they are actually, whether you can argue that David chose the city of Jerusalem, or you can argue that God chose the city of Jerusalem, either way, in the end, God says, yeah, this is the place that your capital is, where you are, this is where I'm going to choose to put my name. This is where I will put my name. This is where people will come from everywhere. Because I will put my name here, and all nations will come. But I will dwell among my people in this place. And the work that they've done. We've talked about this probably for 2 or 3 weeks now, in various locations, whether it's Kings, whether it's in Chronicles, because the Bible continues to talk about it. It must be important. Otherwise, why do you have the explanation of the building of the tabernacle takes much longer than the actual exodus from Egypt, including the story of Moses, including the plagues, including the struggle with the gods of Egypt, including the struggle with the Pharaoh of Egypt, including the bringing and the hearing of the people of Israel of Egypt that there is a God who is strong. All of that, it takes only a few chapters. And then you have the people traveling in the wilderness. And again, It's only a few chapters. Although, once you jump to Numbers in the future, that will be actually a very interesting book. If you haven't read Numbers, a lot of people skip it because it comes right after Leviticus, which you should neither skip Leviticus or Numbers. But if you're into stories and history, Numbers is an amazing historical book. But in the book of Exodus, you only have this short time where the people are traveling. Then, like I said, God could have just said, build the tabernacle, and then it skips forward to today's passage, and the people bring the tabernacle to Moses. Or you could say, God tells the people to build the tabernacle and explains how to do it, and then you assume that they do it because you have a tabernacle a few chapters later. But instead, it goes through all three stages. This is how I want you to build it. This is you participating in building what I told you to build. And then finally, this is you presenting the tabernacle and being blessed by Moses, being blessed by the presence of God, who comes and dwells, lives in the tent, so that the people cannot even approach it, even as here. But they finally are in this location, and again, it's in Kings, it's in Chronicles, it must be important to God. The work that they've done on the temple, who did it? Well, you have three basic people who worked on the temple. I would argue, although I'm sure, in fact, as we read 2 weeks ago, I think, thousands of people worked on the temple. You basically have King David, who gathers everything together, who finds all the material and brings it to Jerusalem and prepares it for his son. You have a foreign king who probably is pagan, probably doesn't actually believe in the God of Abraham and the God of Jacob, but the God of Israel, King Hiram. And he does a lot of work. Now he's an ally of both David and Solomon. And finally, you have Solomon himself. But the first sentence of today's Haftarah, thus all the work that King Solomon did on the house of the Lord was finished. Solomon did it. In another setting, you actually have verses 40 through 50 talk about both Hiram and Solomon, which is a Sephardic reading for today's Haftarah. We'll stick to the Ashkenazi. And the second sentence, Solomon brought in the things that David, his father, had dedicated. David did a lot of the work, even though he was told, you cannot finish it. You cannot build it. But God allowed him to participate in it, to do as much work as he was able to do. And there's no warning against that. He's not accused of doing something that God did not want him to do. And so Solomon brings in the silver, the gold, the vessels that and stores them in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. What does Solomon do next? He brings in the leadership of Israel. And this is actually quite interesting in some ways, in that in large parts of the world, our custom, our tradition, our culture wants to kind of equalize everyone. We don't need like leadership. We don't, Everyone's the same. Whether you're poor or rich, you're the same, which is technically true. Jesus speaks of this in actually Paul. Paul mostly speaks of it. But you have everyone is the same before God. But you still have leaders, you still have heads of the tribe, you have leaders of the houses of the people of Israel. And Solomon brings them in. And presumably, they are also supposed to go back to where they came from. They don't stay in Jerusalem. They're not like, oh, wow, Solomon threw us a party, even though we find out that they did kind of throw a party, particularly in Chronicles, which we'll hopefully get to at some point. But they're supposed to go back. You have the heads of the tribes. And once they finish at the temple, they should be going back to where they came from and say, I saw the temple of my God, and it was filled with the glory of God, so much so that God had to put a cloud or darkness into the temple to cover the glory, because no one could approach, no one could come near to it, and they should be going back and telling their wives and their children and other leaders in their tribes who go on to tell their wives and their children and so on and so forth to say, this is what I saw God do. God is now dwelling in our midst. And the same thing, the leaders of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel, they should be going back. They should be saying, I saw something incredible. Unfortunately, we do know that Israel, like the nations around them, worshipped multiple gods. And basically, no one in the ancient times, anyone before like, 1400s, I'm not sure the exact date, will excuse my ignorance, but there was no such thing as atheism. There were people who were accused of atheism, but that basically meant that they were either Jewish, because the Jews only believed in one God, or they had some form of theism or something like that, where there are gods, but they aren't quite as present. And those accusations even were refuted by the people that were being accused of atheism, usually. Everyone believed in the gods. And Israel was no different. And unfortunately, we will find out that many times, of course, they believed in the God of Abraham. They just happened to also believe in the gods of Tyre and Sidon, the gods of Hiram, the person who helped build the temple. But we should be careful when we see when we see God working. And this is a short application, even though I'm not a big fan of application on average. But when we see God working, we should recognize it. We should look at it and be like, this is my God. And we should be able to go back and tell people, I saw God work today in this person's life or in my life, or he did this, or even, here in Jerusalem, right? It's a bit cold, it's a bit rainy. I got soaked going to work this morning because I didn't bring a umbrella. And of course, the drainage in Jerusalem is not very good on the streets. So your feet end up in puddles that are, unfortunately, I have mesh shoes. So my feet got soaked. But this is the blessing of God. very clear in the Shema, Deuteronomy 63:11. This is God saying, I am giving my blessing to the righteous. I'm giving my blessing to the wicked. Here's rain, which perhaps is not as obvious as the glory of God filling the temple and the great cloud coming down and hiding it so that people can actually be there and participate in the party that will follow. But that's what these people should be doing as they come to Jerusalem, as Solomon gathers these elders. And what do they do? So this is probably one of the main parts. You have the obvious correlation of the building of the tabernacle, the building of the temple. You have the cloud that fills the tabernacle, the cloud that fills the temple. But Solomon brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. And then later on, all the elders of Israel came, and the priest took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of the Lord, the tent of meeting, and all the holy vessels that were in the tent. The priests and the Levites brought them up, and King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who had assembled before him were with him before the ark of the covenant. And it's very important that it keeps referring to the covenant, which also is true in Exodus 38 through 40. They sacrificed many sheep and oxen that could not be counted or numbered. Just a brief aside, we'll come back to the ark hopefully in about a minute. But oftentimes in Christianity, we talk about how we quote scripture and say to obey is better than to sacrifice. That's true. Of course, to sacrifice is being obedient to God. Because if you do not sacrifice, you're actually not obeying God. Now, in this particular case, we don't sacrifice sheep or oxen anymore. Neither did the Jewish people, because the temple isn't there, and it's very clear in the Torah that these sacrifices were to happen in the place that God chose. So they're not going to do that anymore. However, yeah, to obey is better than the sacrifice, but sacrificial giving is commanded by God. And peace offerings are also. I'd have to actually double check to see if peace offerings and free will offerings are commanded by God in general, but free will offerings are also very good things to give, which again, we looked at a couple weeks ago when we were in Chronicles, I believe. David gave free will offerings and he asked the people to give free will offerings so that all of these things, the silver, the gold, and the vessels that Solomon is bringing to the temple, a lot of this came from free will offerings. But back to the ark. Then the priests brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house, in the most holy place, underneath the wings of the cherubim. But the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the ark, so that the cherubim overshadowed the ark and its poles. And the poles were so long that the ends of the poles were seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen from outside. And they are there to this day, which gives a little bit of insight into when this might have been written. Because at some points in history, those poles would not have been there. There is nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And I'm going to go over this particular part probably the most in depth today. There is nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. Again, this is the Ark of the Covenant. God made a covenant with the people of Israel. And this covenant, as was preached actually on Sunday, was largely one of a husband and wife covenant. That was what God wanted. And you see that in places like Hosea, I believe, where God wanted Israel to be like a wife to him, where you have this community, where you have this unity, where you have this intimacy. And we know eventually that the covenant became almost more of a suzerain covenant, where one person is the master and the other one is, they're blessed by the master, right? Because they, what are they going to do if the king says, you know what, I don't actually want to keep my covenant? What are the people going to do if the king says, you know what, actually, I want to tax you twice as much as I did before? What are the people going to do? Part of the difference is, though, that God never changed. He didn't divorce his people, even though they went to many lovers. He did not. He kept his covenant. However, there is nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb. What should be in the ark? The Ark of the Covenant, there should be articles in it. It's a box. It's supposed to be a receptacle for items that go inside of it. Of course, the first thing that we talk about, that we know about, and what's written here, is that the stone tablets would go in there. What many people would say is the representation of the covenant, where in a covenant, you make two different, what are they called? Writings, we'll say for now. Two different writings where one would go to one party and the other would go to the other party. And in the case of God, he says, here's the covenant. I want to dwell among you. Here's my covenant. And then he gives both of the covenants, both of the signings of the covenant, the writings of the covenant, for Israel to keep. He doesn't need to be able to read his side of the covenant. He will keep it. He will always keep it. He says in Jeremiah that Israel will never disappear. As long as there are stars in the sky, as long as there is a heaven and an earth. And so he gives both parts of the co both there's a technical word for it that I'm sure everyone but me can remember. But he gives both sides of the covenant writing, the what would be used to remind the parties that this is the covenant that they have to Israel. But that was only one thing that went in the Ark of the Covenant. There's another thing that should be in the Ark of the Covenant. And what is that? Manna. There should be a pot of manna that was in the Ark of the Covenant. And actually, Jewish writing states that the manna was put into a gold pot. because, of course, it should be beautiful, it should be artistic, it should be something that worships God in all the senses. But the manna, the provision of God after he's made this marriage covenant, after the people say, why aren't you providing enough? Why aren't you giving what we need? God says, okay, here's manna, here's water, here's quail, meat. I'll give you everything you need. And this is the representation of God's providence, that God gave them everything they needed. Manna in the wilderness. Every day he gave them manna. We have in Exodus 16, Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. So, what happened to it? What happened to this jar that the manna was put into? Well, we don't actually know. What we do know is that in between the time of Moses and Aaron putting this jar in the ark and the time that Solomon is now going to put the Ark of the Covenant into the temple, the people turned away from God. We'll come to that in a moment. Because there's something else that should be put, that should be in the Ark of the Covenant, and that is Aaron's rod. Aaron's rod is also supposed to be in the Ark. Numbers 17. Then Moses brought all the staves from before the Lord to all the people of Israel. So the people of Israel challenge the leadership that God had put in place. Are these the priests? Are these really the people of God? Are these the ones who are supposed to lead us? They challenge it. And they looked at the staves that had been brought before God, and each man took his own staff. So these are the people who would be leaders. However, one staff was different. The staff of Aaron had blossomed and had become like an almond tree, I believe. And so when they take their staff, everyone else takes their staff and goes home. But the Lord said to Moses, put back the staff of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign for the rebels, that you may make an end of their grumbling against me, lest they die. Thus did Moses as the Lord commanded him, so he did. So you have these three things. First, you have the covenant, the tablets that represent the covenant, and it is put into the ark for the people to remember. You have the manna, the providence of God, that is put in the ark for the people to remember that God is gracious. And then you have the staff of Aaron, which is supposed to be a warning to those who would rebel against God. And then no different than what we read in the New Testament, Romans 3, what is the punishment for sin? It is death. What is the punishment for rebellion? It is death. And so God is going to put Aaron's staff into the ark, this witness that you should not rebel. In Hebrews chapter 9, it says, behind the second curtain is a second section called the Most Holy Place, having the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant, covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna. Also, not only Jewish tradition, but probably a Hebrews is written by a Jewish person, still Jewish tradition, I suppose, but the writer of Hebrews, a golden urn holding the manna, and Aaron's staff that had budded, and the tablets of the covenant above it, with a cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things, we cannot now speak in detail. Why? Why can he not speak in detail of these things at this moment? Because the ark was gone. The ark had not been seen, I believe, since the time of Hezekiah, the end of the Hezekiah's life. But even in the time of Solomon, in our reading today, two of the three things that were supposed to be in the ark, the thing that told of God's benevolence, and the thing that warned of rebellion, were no longer in the ark. And again, I say, what happened? The people of Israel rebelled and they turned away from God. You read this in the book of Judges. Over and over and over, the people did what was right in their own eyes. And then they would be punished. And they would fall under the rule of an enemy nation. And they would call out to God. And once again, even though they had rebelled, God would be gracious, even as he had with the manna. He provided them with judges. He provided them with peace in specific areas of the country. And then you get to Samuel. And in the book of Samuel, you have Eli and his two sons, and the priesthood is becoming corrupt. And Eli and his two children will die. And this is the story of Samuel growing up. And the Philistines come and they attack children of Israel. The children of Israel, they grab the Ark of the Covenant and they say, this will save us. This thing will save us. And I'm sure in the back of their minds, all of them, again, no one was an atheist. They probably did recognize that this ark was not God. They knew that. Or at least most of them probably knew that. They knew that God was not gold or wood. But they thought that if they had this thing, God would save them. And God did not. The Philistines go ahead and they defeat the Israelites. The two sons of Eli are killed. And then the story jumps forward, and a man from Benjamin runs through from the battle all the way to Shiloh, which is in Ephraim. And he comes to Eli, and Eli hears the news of his sons dying and the capture of the Ark of the Covenant, and he falls over and he's dead. Now, the battle and Shiloh are on opposite sides of Benjamin. So, why would a Benjaminite run past his home to Shiloh? Why wouldn't he stop? Well, the Bible doesn't talk about this part of it, but history does. And in fact, later on in Jeremiah, the Bible does talk about it. The Philistines did not stop at the first battle. They continued through Benjamin and sacked Shiloh. And they probably took gold, silver, articles that had been previously holy, consecrated, given freely by the people who left Egypt because of rebellion. And the Philistines take it to their own towns. And if you have a pot that's full of gold and it has some stuff in it, what are you going to do with it? Well, I want that one now. It's mine. I conquered, therefore the spoil is mine. Oh, what's this branch? Don't need that anymore. Right? Now, this is a little bit of conjecture, but this is what kingdoms did when they conquered foreign gods, when they conquered foreign nations. They would take, and that's what the Philistines did. They placed the Ark of the Covenant before their own gods, before Dagon. And they said, "Our gods are stronger." At which point, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob said, no, your gods are not stronger." And Dagon fell over. The Philistines are forced to return the Ark of the Covenant to Israel because they were in pain. They were suffering from various tumors and boils and things like that. They return the Ark of the Covenant. But when we, the next time we see, theoretically, because it doesn't actually say they opened it, but the next time we see the Ark of the Covenant, only the stone is left. The gold urn, it's gone. The golden jar that held the manna, it's gone. The branch that had bloomed that warned the people not to rebel, it's gone. One Jewish source, Tosefta 2:13, does say the jar of the manna and the flask of anointing oil and the staff of Aaron with its almonds and blossoms and the chest that the Philistines brought in honor of the God of Israel, all of these were within the Holy of Holies. But from the time that the ark was hidden away, they were hidden away with it. This is speaking of the time of Hezekiah, I believe, although I think there was also a king earlier who had also hidden away the ark. But it doesn't actually seem to match up with our passage here in Chronicles because those things were no longer there. And I think that is a warning. If God's provided, don't overlook it. If God is warned, don't overlook it. Pay attention to the things that God has done, even though he never stopped the covenant. The stone tablets were still there. That is a large part of my time. So I'll jump forward real quick to the cloud, the very next verse. There is nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt, and when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud. For the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. And I will argue that God was gracious in that he waited for the priest to leave because they would not probably have been able to be there and survive if he had immediately filled the place with his glory. So that's a very interesting situation. And again, this comes out of a very similar passage in our Exodus passage, which is Exodus 40, verse 34. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it. You might think to yourself, it's a cloud. That doesn't stop anybody from going anywhere. Yeah, you just walk through. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, the people of Israel would set out. Again, this tabernacle, you could move it because they had not yet gotten to the land that God had promised. They had not yet gotten to the city that God would choose to put his name. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out till the day that it was taken up. For the glory of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. Now, one question I would ask is, okay, you have this magnificent, glorious thing, the cloud and the glory of God, which again, as we mentioned earlier, the glory of God in almost every situation is connected to light. Why wasn't it always there? The temple stood for, well, actually not that long, 300 plus years. But why wasn't the glory of God always shining out of the temple? There's this thing that people could look at, the elders of the tribes of Israel, the leaders of the father's house, they saw the glory of God fill the temple, or at least they would have if God had not been gracious enough to put the cloud first. Because again, the priests came out of the holy place, and then a cloud filled the house of the Lord. As it says in Exodus 40, not even Moses could approach the place where people were supposed to meet God. So you might argue, wow, I would love to be in a place where a miracle was happening every single second of every single day. But this particular miracle would have said, you're going to have trouble meeting God because you cannot approach the location when the glory of God is in that place. The priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, it says here, right? The people would perhaps come with their offerings, their lambs, their pigeons, their cakes of raisins, their cakes of grain, their oil. And again, a reminder, most offerings were non-blood offerings. Most of them were grain offerings, flour offerings, cakes of raisin, oil offerings, things like that. Even first fruits and things like that. That's the majority of offerings that were supposed to be given to God, which should not diminish the blood offerings, but it doesn't glorify them either. Both were an offering to God. Both were to give God, to worship God, to stand before him and say, yes, you are the God who created me. Yes, you are the God who is given so gracious to me. Yes, you are the God who warned me not to rebel. And they would bring these gifts, and the priest would go, sorry. Temple is filled with the glory of God. Can't do anything for you today. Go home. Maybe come again next year. Although this is kind of the eternal flame, so next year doesn't look good either. So maybe it's a good thing that God did not continue to fill the temple with his glory every day, every second. A real quick note, in First Kings, it says that this is in the seventh month of the year, and it talks about the feast in the seventh month. Now, this could be two different feasts, or if it's holiday, I should have looked up the word. It could be three different holidays, holy days. You have what is today called Rosh Hashanah, which at the time was the Feast of Trumpets, the blowing of the trumpet. You have Yom Kippur, which wouldn't classically be called a feast, as you fast on it. And you have Sukkot. First Kings doesn't mention which of these it is. However, if you go to a parallel passage in Chronicles, Second Chronicles chapter 7, it says that they celebrated, they held the feast for 7 days. And the end of the seventh day is the 23rd day of the seventh month. So, which feast is it? It's Sukkot. What is Sukkot about? God dwelling among his people. And God has come down and he's chosen the place that he will put his name, which is only mentioned later on in the book of Psalms, that Jerusalem is, in fact, the place that God chose his name. Could have been Shiloh. But God didn't complain when the people set up the tabernacle for several hundred years in a single location, Shiloh. But he also didn't pick it. He also didn't choose that's the place. He waited and waited and waited, and now he comes and dwells in the temple for I don't know if it's all 7 days or just briefly that one day, but he dwells there, and it's when the people are celebrating Sukkot, God dwelling among his people, God giving even the Torah, because that is how the people meet with God. They follow, they obey him, they listen to his commands, and they walk after him. And they love him with all of their heart, with all of their soul, with all of their might. They love their neighbors themselves. If they're not doing that, how are they going to meet with God? So this is the date that we're looking at. And finally, very briefly, Solomon turns around. He's very happy that God has come, filled the place with the thick darkness or the cloud. It's the same word that's used in Exodus chapter 20. Even though here it's translated as thick darkness, it's the same word as the cloud that covers the mountain. Then the king turned around and blessed all the assembly of Israel. There's a blessing given. Interestingly enough, it either doesn't tell us what Solomon's blessing to the people was here, or the blessing looks awfully, not really like a blessing to the people, but a blessing to God. However, in Chronicles, it does say again that he gave to the people cakes of raisins. He gave to the people food for the festival, for the 7 day period. He provided food for them. What is a blessing? We often think of a blessing as a statement. And so when we bless God, which he will do here, he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel." We kind of think of it as a statement, but in fact, how does God bless us? With gifts. He gave manna to the people. Each day, he blessed them with manna from heaven. He does things, he acts. And so, if we want to bless God, yes, we can bless him with our words, with our thoughts, but we bless him by how we act, what we do, by following in the ways that he wants us to go. So we don't actually, I would argue, we don't actually know what Solomon's blessing to the people was. I might even argue that it is the food that he provides, and not he's not taking over the priestly duties, which again, some of the blessings are strictly supposed to come from the priests, as you see in Numbers. But he can bless the people in other ways. And in the end, his final declaration is that God has fulfilled the promises that he declared he would. Everything that God had promised to David, to Solomon, all of these things he followed through on. And in return, Solomon did his best and David did his best to follow through on what they had said they would do. And now, the ark in which the covenant of the Lord that he made with our fathers when he brought them out of the land of Egypt has a place to stay in the middle of the people as God dwells with his people. So, with that, if there are any questions, hopefully there are quite a few. Discussion is always good. Again, some of these topics, they don't necessarily jump out at you the first time you read them as something of, oh, I'll skip this. Why did God put this in? But I think there's a lot to go through here, and it is incredibly interesting. We didn't even touch on some of the things. In part because I didn't have time to research everything like the cherubim, etc. So if that's the question that you want to ask, good luck as we discuss it. But there's a lot to go through in here.
Thanks for joining us in the scriptures today. You may have noticed that it sounds like this podcast is part of a larger discussion on those scriptures. Well, that's because it is. We welcome you to join us live each Tuesday evening at 9 p.m. Jerusalem time, for our online Bible study of Kings and Prophets, Voices from the Haftarah. You can find the sign-up link at our social media pages at Christ Church Jerusalem. This podcast has been a production of Christ Church Jerusalem and CMJ Israel. We'd like to thank our teachers, producers, and most of all, our friends who make this Bible study a joyful endeavor week to week. And in fact, we hope to see you next week. Until then, blessings from Jerusalem.